Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, 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 everyone. Welcome. Couple of questions to start today's show. First one, is sex addiction a real disorder or convenient excuse for those who stray and get caught? Is it really possible to reprogram our brain to fall back in love? And we'll also be looking at what's the most important thing to do if we want to win an argument without losing our cool. Well, those are questions we're going to get answered today, starting with George Collins, and I'll introduce him in just a moment. My second guest today is Dr. Fran Cohen-Praver. She's a clinical psychologist, relationship expert, and author of The New Science of Love. Understanding your brain's wiring can help you rekindle your relationship, she says. And we're going to end today's show with the author of How to Win Any Argument Without Losing Your Cool with mediator, negotiator, Robert Mayer. First, I'm very pleased to welcome George N. Collins. He's my first guest today. He's the founder and director of Compulsion Solutions, an outpatient counseling service in the Bay Area specializing in the treatment of men who suffer from the results of sexually compulsive behavior. He is a former addict himself and a member of the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health and is recognized as an expert on sexually compulsive behavior. His new book is called Breaking the Cycle, Free Yourself from Sex Addiction, Porn Obsession, and Shame. George Collins, welcome to the show.
Well, it's great. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, we've all heard Tiger Woods, Anthony Weiner, and many, many more to add to the list who claim to be sex addicts after they got caught, And I avoided doing any stories at all on any of that because I probably, like many radio hosts, I got inundated with material about people who wanted to talk about sex addiction in particular. And I avoided that until I came across your book because I think this is really well done and I think it's a really useful tool for people who might be going through this. But I want to clear this up, first of all, before we go any further, George. I want to get a better understanding of a few issues around sex addiction. What I really want to start off with today is there's still such a lot of controversy around is sex addiction a genuine disorder or a convenient excuse? What do you have to say to that?
Well, what I would say is that everyone's addicted to sex. It's just a matter of degree. It's similar to food. You have to eat, and most everybody biologically has to be sexual. So sex, if you think back to your what we call euphoric recall, some people got food as a gift to stimulate them when they were kids. Mommy gives them cookies, and so a lot of times people will be hooked up to food later in life around the euphoric recall of food. And likewise, if you find the Playboy magazines of your dad's or the porn tapes, or nowadays, if kids go online and find their father's material on the website leavings on the computer, then they're going to get hooked up to that because it's exciting and it's thrilling. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever had a bad orgasm.
Right, well, true. Eric's nodding his head too. So does the psychiatric manual, the DSM-5, does that recognize sex addiction as
an
addiction
yet.
Now?
They're still struggling in the psychological community about whether to put that in. The only thing that's in there are drugs and alcohol at this point. And I kind of wish that some of the people that are struggling over this would come sit in my office for a day and listen to the terrible, terrible stories of people that are absolutely, without a doubt, addicted to compulsive sexual behavior.
Mm. I actually read an interesting article. It was a couple of years old, but Dr. Christopher Lane advocates that it should be in the DMS manual, the psychiatric manual.
Right.
He said it's really the way that the book is put together. The conflict is due to an underlying flaw in the manual's conception. So that aside, it's not in the manual yet, but it's, you know, I've talked with several psychiatrists and psychologists over the years, and they've all agreed that there is definitely a compulsive behavior there that they class as as addiction. So tell us what a sex addict would look like. What is the typical kind of behavior and how this differs from somebody who's just very interested in sex or just very passionate?
Yeah, I think that what you have to look for, if your listeners are interested in this, is your work slipping? Is your intimacy with your partner slipping away? Are you having less sex, actual sexual activity? And are you moving toward more towards the internet or more towards the strip club or more towards the massage parlor type thing? Is it harming your relationships, any relationships you have, including just personal friendships? Are you isolating? These are things that people have to note. And it usually takes what we call a bottom for people to wake up. It's just the most amazing thing. You know, I had a guy last week that came in. He called up and he said, I just need to see you. And I just happen to have an open spot for some reason. And we're usually always pretty full. And so he dropped by. And he said, in the trunk of my car are all my possessions from my office. I went to there today, and the security guards were at the door, and they handed them to me, and my media supervisor was there and said, you're done here, and there's nothing to talk about. And he had a $175,000 a year job.
Wow. So it's pretty much like any addiction, they do say, you know, I've heard over and over again that people really have to hit bottom before they're ready to make change?
Well, most of the bottoms are, and luckily there's things called wives and girlfriends and boyfriends
in gay life.
And luckily there's those kind of people. And most of the time, they're understanding to a point. And most of the time, a lot of the times, I get calls from wives who say, what do I have to do to sell Bob or Joe or Bill on the idea that he's a mess? Because he's not having sex with me, he's not coming home at night, he's spending a lot of money and I don't know where it's going, and what can I do? So I tell her actually we have a website, compulsionsolutions.com, where I have some TV shows that are recorded on there, and one of them is one where I had to come clean because I got to the show. This is several years ago, and I got to the show and looked across the stage. I was supposed to debate a famous porn star, and I looked across the stage, and it was the exact porn star I was addicted to when I was in my mess.
Mm.
And so I threw away my prepared text. And so when men look at that particular video, the top video on the video page, they really, if they're going to at that point, they'll cheer up. Mm. And oftentimes call me and say, I'm sorry, I just didn't know what a mess it was.
Right.
Denial is something you have to get over.
You know? Yeah.
The story that, oh, gee, everybody's doing it. Everybody's looking at some pictures and everybody's messing around once in a while. Well, then maybe some people can do that, but I can't.
Right. I want to get into story because you mentioned denial and you say if we have no story, if we tell ourselves we have no story, then we're in denial. But before we get there, I just want to talk about the what you call the amphitheater of the mind. Motivational speaker Maxwell Maltz talks about using the theater of your mind to envision and create a better future for yourself. In chapter 2, Identifying the Voices of Your Amphitheater, you share an entirely different metaphorical view there. So I wonder if you'd tell us a little about that so we can try and understand what's going on in the mind of a sex addict.
Yeah, in graduate school, the school I went to had a particular format for the thesis, and it wasn't an easy one. It was, why did you come here, what did you learn, and what are you going to do with it? And you had to satisfy two or three stony-faced PhDs with an oral argument. So one of the points that I made in my thesis was, how will I explain the human mind to the average guy, to the regular guy that walks in here that doesn't have anything to do with psychology? So the way I did it was to construct the notion of your mind being an amphitheater, and that it's pitch black, and that you're standing in the middle of the amphitheater, and you're hearing all these voices. And one voice will say, go get a Penthouse magazine and masturbate. And another voice will be, and it's pitch black. You can't tell who it is. There's spotlights on you, so you can't see. Mm-hmm. You know there's people in the amphitheater that are yelling out at you, but you're just sort of dumb. You're just struck dumb. So my job is to turn the lights on in the amphitheater with my clients and to find out who these voices are, how old they are, when did they start, what's the deal, what's going on. The way I do that is to help them learn how to dialogue with that voice. Mm. So a lot of my clients will actually talk. They'll write a script, a re-script for themselves. They'll write to their addict and talk to the addict. And people say, if I talk to myself, I'll go crazy. And I say, no, my friend, if you talk to yourself, you'll go sane.
Right, right. Well, so much of what we read today, and this has been written for many, many, many centuries, tells us that we are what we think. And you dedicate a whole chapter in the book to you are not your mind, you are not your thoughts, you are much more than your thoughts. And you talk about the importance of uncovering your story, which you just touched on loosely,
right.
Because you say many of these addictions begin in childhood by some traumatic event or just a chain of events or a particular person.
Yeah, there are coping strategies. Eating and drugs and alcohol and sex can be, and eating can be a coping strategy if you overdo it. So I'm not sure I heard the question.
Well, so you talk about story, and you say if we don't have a story, we're in denial, and it's because we want a better story.
So you can have a better story, but then you aren't that either. So what my point is that you are what I call essence. All of us are our essential self, and that's what you were when you were a little baby, before people started talking, before your mother spanked you, before your father left and abandoned the family, before the problems started, before you had to start coping, before you had to start doing something to feel better about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so my job is to help people become their essential self.
Right.
It's been Eastern philosophy talks about the way to do that is by meditation. And in Western world, we don't meditate all that well. Regular guys don't meditate that well. So what I try and get them to do is to just talk to essence, just understand that there is this essential self that can help you. It has all the answers. And the answers don't come in the normal way. They're not archived in your mind.
Right.
Your mind is just a repository for information and feelings that happen to you over your years. Some is good, some is good, not so good.
Yeah, and a couple of examples you give some great examples in the book, which I think really helps put this into context for people. But you talk about the people who've been affected. One guy was affected by it because the family focus was on appearances versus intimacy. Another had distant parents, you say guilt is a huge component that fuels sex addiction. Are you talking there by people who are raised in families where it's not talked about, where it's considered dirty?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't think of right now any person that has ever walked in my office that's had the talk. One of our therapists here at Compulsion Solutions specializes in having the talk with families, with a young man there, because families have such a hard time talking about sexual issues. So where did we learn it? Well, we learned it on the street. We learned it in the locker room. And we all bragged, and we all didn't know what we were talking about. And we made believe.
Right, right.
And the more sex you had, the better you were. None of my friends ever talked about what a wonderful girl Janie was. Or Ruthie, and how they went over to her house and had a wonderful time, and her mother was so nice. Everybody was talking about trying to get Janie out of the house in the backseat of a car.
Now,
it was crazy.
So it's very important then for parents to have that talk with kids when they're young.
But it's also important to role model intimacy if you can, to hold hands, to hug, to kiss, to show your kids. Your kids are watching you. Anybody that's listening, your children are watching every move you make.
Yeah, it was interesting for me, the few people that I talked with about this. I actually did, I put a quick post on Twitter, and I was amazed by all the answers that came back. You know, people believed, you know, they really couldn't help themselves. They have no choice in this. Others actually went as far as to say, you know, they had issues with a parent or whatever. But the general consensus on the people I actually talked with was that they had a very distant mother on some point. Now, of course, this, I'm not a clinician, and this was a very unscientific study.
Right, right.
But I just wanted to put my own feelings
out
there.
No, I hear you, and you're right.
Yeah.
You're right, yeah. Well, the book was written for an eighth grade mentality, which is about the mentality I was when I was acting out sexually, even though I was an adult. And so it's easy to read, in some ways, and sometimes it's difficult to read because it's so close to the truth, because it's written by an addict to help other sex addicts.
Right. Now, as a recovering addict yourself, what would you tell wives and girlfriends whose partner's behavior they're worried about?
Well, if they need some help, just give us a call. We talk to anybody for 15 or 20 minutes, anybody at no charge. I mean, it's just call up and find out. So if they have questions, there are places that are available. There's also Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous and groups for wives and partners that correspond to Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous and Sexaholics Anonymous and Sex Addicts Anonymous. There's three S groups, as they're called. And Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous has a corresponding group for partners.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to be with women and talk about it, fine. If you just want some help or just want some ideas, go to the website, compulsionsolutions.com. There's a page there for women. And either Faye or Paldrum, my wife, will be happy to talk to you. Their phone numbers are there, and they're easily available.
Mm. Now, I have to say, your personal story is very interesting because you're a former addict. You were married to a former Buddhist nun.
I am now, yes.
Were you married to her at the time or
no.
After you healed?
Post-addiction.
Post-addiction.
Yeah, post-addiction, thank God,
yeah.
I must be doing something right if a former Buddhist nun will meet me, right?
What for you personally, and maybe you see this repeated, maybe you see a common denominator amongst your patients too, but what for you personally was probably the biggest struggle or challenge you had to overcome during your recovery?
Just the constant gnawing. And the people that are listening that are addicted to anything will understand this. The desperate, unconscious need for chocolate, for me, for sex, for porn. I was a porn addict. I was sexually abused by my own mother, so it's a no-brainer. I became a porn addict because I didn't want to be around real women, because unconsciously I would recreate incest every time I was with real women, until I wasn't. But it's the gnawing part, the mind, the story, the negative subpersonality in the amphitheater saying, come on, George, come on, you need this, you need it. Come on, do it now. Just once. We don't have to tell anybody.
Right, right.
You don't need help. Everybody does this, George.
Right.
And this is the story of George. That was the hardest to overcome. And, I started out in the 12 steps. Then I found a wonderful therapist that was able to really start me. And then I said to myself, I'm just going to dedicate myself to helping men all over the world. Well, actually, we work with men on the telephone all over the world. Mostly this country and Canada, but we love our people. Mm. We actually do care what happens to them.
Right, right. I can tell. Now, if somebody is in the height of this addiction and they are in a relationship, is there hope for that relationship?
Absolutely. Hopefully, you'll have us back, and you can talk to my lovely wife, Paldrum, when her book comes out, which will be next month. Our book, the Couple's Guide to Sex Addiction.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, George?
Well, what I'd like to say if anybody gives me a podium, is that I got over this, and so can you. Don't stay in denial. What happens to people after they get over this, and I'm living proof because I took the worst thing that ever happened to me and built it into a thriving business. Most of the people that leave here make a ton more money because, oh, what the hell? Why not work? I'm not a sex addict anymore. And they have friends, and they have hobbies, and they have deep, connected relationships. And there is hope. And life can be fun, really, what I call the real F word.
Yeah, it's a good note to end our segment on. And you're doing great work out there. Thank you so much for being with us today. And please do give out your website one more time. So you said that anybody can contact you.
Anybody can contact us, and you'll be called back probably within an hour. We don't wait long. CompulsionSolutions.com. And take a look at the videos. Take a look at the people that have written in that have gotten well. And there's all kinds of good stuff on there. We really try to make it an inclusive site. Also, the book is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it's out in the stores now. I went out the other day and signed some copies.
Well, fabulous. I appreciate you being with us. Great information. And this really is a good book. It's called Breaking the Cycle, Free Yourself from Sex Addiction, Porn Obsession, and Shame.
Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you.
All right, have a good day.
You too. My guest, George N. Collins. And coming up next, we'll be joined by Dr. Fran Cohen-Prever, author of The New Science of Love. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
More talk, less rock. Come on, that's a good thing. Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Dr. Fran Cohen-Prever. She's the author of The New Science of Love. And in this book, Dr. Fran Cohen-Prever draws on cutting-edge neuroscientific findings and 2 decades of her own experience as a therapist to say that when love fades, we can quite literally use our brains to bring it back. Well, Dr. Prever is a relationship analyst and clinical psychologist. She specializes in women's issues and intimate relationships. And she's written 2 previous academic books. She also blogs for Psychology Today and is quoted as an expert in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and many others, and has also been regularly appeared on radio and television. So I'm very pleased to have you with us today, Dr.
Prever. Thank you, and I'm so pleased to be there.
So let's begin with what you call the new science of love. Tell us, neuroscientists have analyzed brain systems indicating the tiny brain cells called mirror neurons. Tell us what this means.
Okay, this happened in the 1990s in Parma, Italy. And researchers were working with monkeys, and they found these brain cells behind the eye sockets, and they connected the monkey and the researcher at an internal plane. And the monkey could actually infer what the researcher was going to do without seeing it. So it was really at an internal plane. They were linked together. And then scientists found that we humans have mirror neurons analogous to the monkeys, and our mirror neurons connect us to each other and in a meaningful relationship. And what could be more meaningful than an intimate one? And in an intimate relationship, these mirror neurons connect, you know, partners, and it mirrors the other partner's actions and feelings of attraction, romance, love, lust, good memories, and happy times. And then to ensure that these heady experiences occur, the brain triggers the release of love-inducing chemicals, such as natural pheromones, oxytocin, vasopressin, dopamine, testosterone, natural opiates, along with serotonin and GABA. And so, you know, when we talk that we have chemistry, we actually have chemistry. There's a scientific basis. So I say the brain is the seat of love, and mirror neurons are its beating pulse.
And,
you know, unfortunately, when problems are not resolved, things happen. The mirror neurons connect you and your partner in resentments and disappointments and a waning of passion and sexual desire. And hurtful interactions are repeated over and over. You know how we keep repeating the same thing? It may be another wrinkle, but basically it's the same deal. And it gets lodged into the brain. And those loving, you know, chemicals, they're on hold.
Right.
And it seems like the end of love and passion, but it needn't be.
Right. So I just want to go over that again. Because in the book you say critical attacks, when we're critically attacking one another, we create wounds on each other. And those critical attacks put the production of vasopressin and oxytocin on hold.
Exactly.
And those are important to a relationship because, according to the book, they produce feelings of trust and loyalty. And obviously, you can't have a very intimate relationship without feelings of trust and loyalty.
Exactly. In your previous segment, talked about sex addiction. I have it in my practice. And I have the woman whose husband was a sex addict. It's very hard for her to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, certainly she has no feelings and she has no good chemistry going on right now. But the good part is that our brains are plastic. That means when we change our interactions, our brains can change also. And once, even if it's deeply entrenched in the brain, the pain, you can change it. And part of it is because you're connected with these mirror neurons. So if you create change, your partner can't help but create change too. And you will reflect the new changes to each other. And so, yeah. And so there is a lot of hope here. The plasticity of the brain and the connectedness with the mirror neurons, the links. So it only takes one person to begin the change. And in the case of when you hurt each other, you inflict terrible hurts on each other, like you said, critical wounds, you can heal. You just have to know how. You have to have the tools, first of all, to dislodge some of these painful interactions. And then one of the very important things, really, is for women particularly to empower yourself. Women, you cannot create change unless you feel empowered.
Right.
And that means you tune out these messages on the TV with these skinny anorexic models, with the plastic surgery and the Botox that tells you aging is a disease. It's not. It's natural. And think about how savvy you are and how much more sensual you are and more sure of yourself and confident, and you know what you want at this point in your life where these kids do not. So I would go with what you have going for you and really make it happen. And so that, to me, is very important, that you begin to value yourself and communicate in a way to get your needs met.
Right.
Too many people will blame the other person and say, you don't do this, you never do this. And I say that's a no-no.
Yeah,
you really have to look to yourself, explain to your partner what you're feeling, and let him paraphrase it, and let him not interrupt you. This is an exercise. And then he gets to explain what he feels, and you listen,
right.
And you don't interrupt him, and you paraphrase. And when you get each other, that's one step closer.
Yeah.
Then there's a thing called emotional attunement, and empathy. To be emotionally attuned to a person, to really get them, you have to be able to put yourself in their shoes and walk in those shoes. And that's called empathy. And so even if he did something as horrific as sex addiction, and the patient in my practice is having a terrible time forgiving him. And he's doing everything he can to repair it, and he's in therapy. But she's been so badly hurt by what he has done. And the key there is for her to begin to understand why he did it and to have empathy for him. And that's hard. Because if your partner has hurt you, he might not have had, I say he, purposes of discussion, because it could be the other way around too, Vicki.
Right. And I want to talk about the three major relationship traps that you talk about in your book, The New Science of Love. They are the three major relationship the three major relationship traps you say are an unequal balance of power, negative prediction, and disconnecting love from lust. So
yes.
Unequal balance of power, you're talking about sharing of money, sharing of chores. What else?
Sharing of respect. And, you know, a man, and I'm going to use this again, I'm going to sound sexist here, but it's usually the man who dominates and the woman who complies, and she gets lost in this, and she loses herself, and her selfhood, it becomes eroded. And so, and I say it's usually that way, but it could be the other way around. I see women in my practice who are really successful in their careers. Sometimes they make three times as much money as the man. And yet, when I see them alone, she's a different woman. And when she comes in with her partner or her husband, she kowtows to him. She loses herself. Somewhere she's, and this is a young woman. We're not talking about a woman in her 60s. We're talking about a woman in her 30s. And she's still stuck in this old role that women have had of being in the one-down position and making him feel like a man. You don't make anyone feel like a man. You have to really be who you are and show self-respect and value yourself, and then your partner will too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens with unequal partners, and you really lose yourself. And I firmly believe that's a big problem that I see even with young people too much.
Right. Now, in negative prediction, you say we're often looking for traits that we don't like about ourselves and finding them in our partners. You say it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I know. It's kind of uncanny. You think it's like black magic, but it's not. I'm going to reveal the trick. So this is how it works. Let's say you're a woman and you don't really like your aggression or your sneakiness. See, you sort of disown it or you cut it off and pretend that you're very sweet and docile and you're very kind. And somehow you predict or you kind of think you're going to see that in your partner. And sure enough, he acts it out. And here's why. It's because at an unconscious level, you go into certain behaviors where you provoke him into acting those things out for you.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he does. And
I can
then
see
there
that
you
happening.
Are. You're a successful negative, you know, fortune teller.
So we want to avoid that at all costs. And then
we want to be able to value ourselves, the good, bad, and the ugly.
Right.
Really know yourself, all parts of you.
Right. And then the third major trap is disconnecting love from lust, because that can cause all kinds of problems. You say there's never any need for a relationship to be sexless. So how do people disconnect love from lust, and why is that a bad thing?
Usually when they have been hurt. And when you've been hurt, it's terrifying to make love again, because that keeps you even closer to the person. And if you make love, and you usually the love and commitment and devotion continues, but sex is what falls away. And very often it's the woman, but often the man, both of them.
Right.
And they don't want each other sexually. You see, once you have love, commitment, and you also have lust and sexual passion satisfied, you have it all.
Right.
So you have a lot more to lose. And so if you would disconnect the lust and the sexual passion from the relationship, you squeeze, of course, you squeeze the life out of the relationship, but you're safer, because you don't have that much to lose. And so that's kind of what happens. They just sort of, it just goes along, but it really doesn't have the spark. And And right, I really believe right. that you can reconnect it.
Right.
And I go
well,
into that's, exactly that's, how to do it.
You do. This is a really great book, The New Science of Love. And we only have like 1 minute left, Dr. Praver. But I want to say that, like my previous guest, you talked about the importance of letting go of toxic childhood messages and living fully in the moment, because they do, those old toxic relationships we had in childhood can carry forward into our relationships, even though we might try really hard not to be like our father or not to be like our mother. Mm-hmm. Subconsciously, we can often act out that way. And you say the infant-mother relationship is in particularly very important. We have about, you know, just less than a minute. I wonder if you can comment on that for me, please.
Yeah, well, you know, the neural tracts are laid down in infancy. And so if mother has been responsive and attentive, the infant has trusted the world will be. If she was depressed, of course, the infant really doesn't have that kind of trust. And it carries forward into the new relationship. So it's really important that you become aware that what is going on might be a ghost from the past is rearing its head now, and it's not your partner at all. So try to live in the present and try to understand where you came from and delete those messages and write new scripts, because you could do that.
Very good. And let's give out your website and tell people where they can find you, and a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Dr. Praver.
Okay, I think at this time in our lives where there's so much economic stress and turmoil all over the world, I think it's more important than ever to love and be loved in return, because that gives you a sanctuary. That gives you a sense of security in these insecure times. So that's what I really believe in. My website is www.drfranpraver.com, drfranpraver.com.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Great book. Really, really good book. I learned some stuff from here myself.
Thank you so much, Vicky. Thank you. It was great talking to you.
And you too. And my guest, of course, Dr. Fran Cohen-Praver, her book, The New Science of Love, How Understanding Your Brain's Wiring Can Help Rekindle Your Relationship. Some really great information in here. And I've read a lot on the brain and stuff and learned some new things in here. So I really enjoyed that. We are going to be having a conversation. We're going to be playing you a conversation I had with Robert Mayer when we come back on how to win an argument without losing your cool. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Next week on Conversations Live, a short trip to Uganda over the Christmas holidays changed the life of 18-year-old Katie Davis forever. More notably, this remarkable young woman improved the lives of hundreds of orphan children through education and empowerment. Join us for Kisses from Katie next Monday at noon Pacific time on Conversations Live. See conversationslive.net for more information.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregorick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregorick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? tune in to our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM. It starts when I wake up. I'm walking on eggshells all my life. The light of my life. You know how to hurt me. There'll always be something for me. Christ, you bring me to my knees. Can you feel
this? I'm laughing at the music, Eric. I don't know where you find these. I'm walking on eggshells. You bring me to my knees. Like, my gosh, who hasn't been there?
You're talking about arguments.
Who has not been there? So my next guest, I sat down with last week and did a recording with him. And we're going to bring that to you in just a moment. But I want to tell you a couple of things about this book, because unfortunately we did have a few technical issues with the recording and had to shorten it considerably. So I wanted to make some key points on this. My next guest is Robert Mayer. His book is called How to Win Any Argument Without Raising Your Voice, Losing Your Cool, or Coming to Blows. And Robert Mayer conducts negotiation, mediation, and persuasion seminars in the U.S. and abroad. He's the author of other books, too, but he's also a regular media guest, radio and TV, and he's earned business and law degrees from UC Berkeley. He represents, Robert Mayer and his company represent clients negotiating deals on everything from amphitheater developments to the sale of vintage aircraft. So he knows about what he speaks. This is a revised version of How to Win Any Argument. And in this book, he's brought a couple of new concepts. And one of them is what he calls the new normal, a time and place that he says it makes conversations tougher, disagreements are more frequent, conflicts are more trying, and that's obviously because of the economic environment we're living in. It puts additional pressures on people. Work has been cut for many people. Some people have lost their jobs entirely. And so to put this book together, he actually talked with a huge range of people, which is very interesting. He talked with everyone from professional con artists and Top Gun trial lawyers, he put those in the same category there, to superstars who were selling Beverly Hills mansions, television evangelists selling salvation, and infomercial pitchmen selling gadgets. He talked with political speechwriters, professional fundraisers, psychology gurus. And of course, he included all of that. He wrapped it all with the knowledge that he's had for the past 20, 30 years as a mediator and negotiator himself. So we're going to bring that conversation to you now. And I do apologize in advance. The quality isn't the best. But here's Robert Mayer on how to win any argument without raising your voice, losing your cool, or coming to blows. You start the book, chapter one, with saying, get a grip. We have to get a grip of ourselves, which I think is something many of us know intellectually, but in the heat of an argument, there are so many people who want to be the right finders that they forget that. So how do we get a grip on ourselves? How do we empower the situation by controlling ourselves?
Well, let's start off with why it's critical. It's critical because you're going to use the other person's energy to win your argument. The New York Times, in reviewing the book and the book's predecessor, called it mental judo.
Yes, yes.
And so in order to be able to use mental judo and to understand where the other person's coming from and how you're going to parry and deal with their moves, you have to be in control of yourself. And if you're not in control of yourself, you make three or four common mistakes. One is that you start believing that people who are acting emotionally can be persuaded by logic. You have to have a grip on yourself to remember that's not true. You have to have a grip on yourself, Vicki, to realize that it's not that the more you talk does not increase the more you influence. But if you don't have a grip on yourself, then you just naturally think, if I talk more, I'll be more influential. You want to have a grip on yourself, because our tendency is to deal with impossible people by being impossible back. And we interrupt, and we raise our voice, and we always generalize and saying, hey, Vicky, you always or you never.
Right.
Or we'll do disparaging things like saying, hey, Vicky, what's your problem? Or, Vicky, why can't you be reasonable? And so all of those things are the common mistakes, really, because you don't have a grip on yourself and you don't have a sense of direction as to where you want to take the argument.
Now, when we've got what you call a still center, what is that going to feel like to us? So we know we're at that place.
Well, you know, one of the keys to winning arguments is to always remember that people react to the way you act. It's kind of like a tennis game. How you return the ball depends on how the ball is shot to you. So nobody likes a high-powered argument or negotiating machine. You want the other person to act in a way that they'll be receptive to your suggestions and your ideas. And so to do that, you can't be a high-powered argument machine yourself. You have to really create a comfort zone where the other person is going to be receptive and is going to hear your suggestions, is going to hear your ideas, and will, you know, engage in hypothetical experiences with you. Hypothetical experiences, well, look, Vicky, what if we did this? And in order for Vicky to respond, you know, she has to be in a place where she feels comfortable.
Right, and I really like that you call this setting up the consent zone, and you dedicate three whole chapters to this consent zone, constructing it and then linking inside, getting people to first buy into trust, and then leading through it. So how do we create that, Robert, though, if the other person is just, you know, the biggest challenges I've had with people are when people either blast you in the face and they don't want to go there, they just do not want to discuss it, and they use what I call intimidation tactics, where they literally just blow up, or they just shut down like a clam and won't discuss anything. How do you set up a consent zone when you're dealing with people like that?
Well, you know, to begin with, not all your conflicts are with somebody across the street. So sometimes you're going to be across town or in a different state or a different country. So the question has different types of answers. But just generally, one of the big mistakes that people make is that they forget that if a conflict ever is going to be resolved, the chances of it being resolved are substantially greater if you sit down with the other person. That's not always possible, particularly here in Los Angeles, where I live, where it takes 2 hours to get from one end of town to the other on a good day.
Right.
But assuming that you are able to sit down with the other person, it gives you a chance to create a negotiating or an argument environment. And you start off by talking about the great movie you saw last week, or you might serve muffins or some kind of pastry or something just to say, oh, I bought these the other day, they were so good, I thought you might like to try them. And by the way, I'm a professional mediator, and most mediators actually bring food to the mediation so they can start off by offering, you know, scones or muffins or something to the people around the table.
Oh, that's interesting.
And starting on a low-key kind of a threshold as opposed to, you know, going full throttle. But let's assume for a moment, Vicky, that, you know, that you're not able to sit down and create a negotiating or an argument environment. Then what are you going to do? Are you going to send an email, or are you going to write a letter, or are you going to make a phone call? Well, the mistake that we all make is we do what's efficient instead of what's effective. What's effective is meeting with the other person. What's efficient would be to send an email or to make a phone call. But look what happens when you make a phone call. So you're having a dispute with me over some matter, and you decide to pick up the phone and call me. So the first problem is that it may not be a good time for me, but that's only the first of a threshold problem, a bunch of problems. But there are certain risks in making phone calls. One is that it's easier to say no on the phone than it is in person. Vicky, I'm just not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Easier for me to say that to you if I'm not sitting across from you. Also, it takes the other person a lot of patience to be a good listener. And so you have to hope, you know, that they have that patience. Conversations on a phone are much briefer than those in person, so they tend to be more competitive. And anytime there's a conversation and there's brevity, the more brief it is, the more competitive it's going to be. So you have to ask yourself, well, do I really want to make the phone call? On the other hand, I may not want to send an email, because an email itself is kind of high-tech rather than high-touch, and there's no real interfacing with the other person. I want to send a regular letter, something where they can be longer and more definitive than an email. But the problem is, you're never sure whether that letter is going to be understood. You're never sure it's even going to be read. On the other hand, you know, with a letter, there's a chance to reread and understand. So, you know, you have to really kind of determine what's going to make the most sense. If you're going to send that letter, you have to learn how to write a letter that people are going to want to read, are going to read, and are going to understand your point, which most of us don't do. Most of us write, you know, really rambling type letters.
Right. And you do give some great tips in the book about that, because you use a lot of techniques that we'd use as a copywriter or something, but they're very, very effective and very powerful. Some of the most challenging arguments we have are with family. And you talk about finessing consent from family and friends. I wonder if you'd just go through, like, the example you gave in the book was somebody who didn't want to study their homework. But, I mean, that can be adapted to many different situations. I wonder if you'd just walk us through that kind of scenario.
You know, it's interesting, because I do a lot of bookstore interviews. And with this book and its predecessor, I did a lot of radio call-in shows. And almost invariably, they were about change and family. And when you think about it, you know, the most difficult negotiations and arguments that any of us have are the ones at home. Will you acknowledge that, Vicki?
Oh, I must definitely acknowledge that.
You have to acknowledge.
Oh, yes.
So what happened with the teens is that I kept a list of the various suggestions that radio call-in listeners made over a period of about 3 or 4 months. And it turned out there were 17 different suggestions, and all of them were terrible. No, they were, because they were all counterpart.
Well, tell us some of the biggest mistakes we make, then.
I'm going to tell you some of them. One is that, you know, that they argue using logic. I'm not going to use logic on some team. Like, if you don't study, you won't get a good job. If you don't get a good job, you know, you're going to be eating macaroni for the rest of your life.
Yeah, because they can't see beyond, you know, the next hour, really.
Another suggestion that doesn't work are threats. And when we're upset, we tend to make threats that we don't want to carry out. You know, like, if you don't study, if you don't get a good grade on the next test, then I have to tell you, you won't be able to use the car until you're 37 years old. That are not proportionate to the situation. Or they'll try to negotiate with a team to negotiate a solution, but by definition, a negotiation is a compromise, and you shouldn't have to compromise with a team. You might have to compromise with a co-worker, but you don't have to compromise with a team, because you're the parent and they are the child. You can offer all kinds of incentives, which, you know, we tend to do because it's really an easy thing, like, hey, you know, if you do that, you know, then you know, we'll take you off to Shangri-La for a weekend or whatever. But, you know, incentives don't produce good study habits. Which is what you want done. You want, you know, not compliance, you want commitment. And so incentives don't give you commitment, they just give you temporary compliance.
Right.
Or you can do strong arm techniques But, you know, if you start strong-arming that family member, it only, you know, leads to resentment. Or if you have some domination kind of play, like, look, this is what you're going to do, and you're going to do it because I'm telling you and because I'm your mom. Well, that leads to a power struggle. So then the question is, well, you know, none of these things work, and they don't give me, you know, commitment, and they might give me temporary compliance, or they just might do nothing more than create a lot of hostility at home. So the book actually spends a couple chapters on developing what's called self-persuasion. And self-persuasion is a technique where you actually enable that teen to persuade themselves that studying and going to school and all of that is what is, makes the most sense for them. But they have to discover it for themselves rather than you're laying it on them as part of a logic argument.
Yeah. You say consistently through the book, people, you know, you have to trust, create the trust first, and then people will buy into the ideas. And we are right at the end of our show. So thank you so much for being with us. My guest there, Robert Mayer, How to Win Any Argument. Please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.